This is The Sector, and I am your host here on The Sector, Ethan Clow. Welcome to the show, everybody. The Sector, of course, is where we discuss nonprofits, social justice, and activism. And as always, we are broadcasting right here on CITR, 101.9 FM in Vancouver. It's on your radio dial. If you are listening online, welcome to the show. We stream every episode, every show on CITR at citr.ca. And of course, if you're listening via podcast, well, welcome whenever, wherever you are. And you can subscribe to the podcast at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. Well, welcome to the show, everybody. This is episode 46 of The Sector. On today's show, we have a great one. We're going to be discussing the fallout of the FIFA corruption arrest that we talked about last week on the show. In fact, I'm going to play a clip from you from John Oliver on his HBO show. He covers the issue in a usual flair of entertainment and information, so we'll play that. Should be funny. We're also going to do a bit of prep for next week's show. I want to talk about the Truth and Reconciliation inquiry that's been going on. I don't want to get too into it since we're going to devote more time next week, but there have been a couple developments that I wanted to highlight, including some political ramifications that I think are really important. Then a bit later in the show, we're going to take a look at an article that appeared on Charity Village talking about attracting the next generation of millennials to work in the nonprofit sector, which kind of dovetails quite nicely with last week's segment about being an employee in the nonprofit sector. So we'll look at what Charity Village has to say about millennials and where they fit in. I guess I would fall into that category as well, so we'll see where I fit in that as well. But a bit of good news from the world of CITR, the radio station that we're broadcasting on right now. After 46 years being in the Student Union building here at UBC, CITR, Discorder, and the rest of the sub are moving into the brand new Student Union building, which is right across from the old Student Union building. It's going to be quite the thing. I've actually gone through it myself, the new building. It's quite nice. It's very sleek and modern and looks altogether quite happy place to do homework or get some food or get some coffee. So it should be a very exciting experience. Now, the big news for CITR, of course, is that the station will have a brand new home, and it's not going to be in the basement or on the top floor behind the gymnasium. It's going to be front and center. We have a really modern new studio, a big glass wall so that programmers doing their shows are actually visible to the students who are hanging around outside. It's going to be really exciting. It's going to hopefully usher in a new era of student involvement. It's going to make the station far more accessible and far more present in campus life. And that's going to be pretty fantastic. Hopefully that'll lead to more student programmers and just ultimately more involvement in campus radio and community engagement. Now, that being said, it is a little bit sad to be leaving the old Student Union building where CITR has operated for the past 46 years. But don't worry, there is going to be a wake for the old CITR station. That's happening on Friday, June 26th at 7 o'clock, goes to 10 o'clock p.m. And you're all invited, members, friends, donors, fans, alumni. You can all come and say goodbye to CITR's old digs. And, you know, celebrate the legacy that went on there, the amazing contributions to civic engagement, to radio, to independent music, to spoken word, to everything, and appreciate all that's come before. Following the wake, there'll be the last and then first broadcast of CITR. So that is happening on Saturday the 27th, 1 to 5 p.m. The switch over to the new studios at 2 p.m. So expect the final broadcast of CITR to happen there, a Saturday. And then the first broadcast of the brand new studio will begin shortly after 2 o'clock. It's going to be pretty exciting. I mean, this is a major advancement for campus community radio here in this city. CITR has been around for, as we said, for a very long time. More than, well, about 80 years or so, I guess. I guess so. And this is a big step up for the station, for the staff, the programmers. and hopefully it's going to usher in a new age, a glorious golden age of campus community radio. Well, anyway, I'm looking forward to it. I'm sure that you're looking forward to it as well. But let's take a quick commercial break here and reference CITR. We'll be back after this.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts on Commercial Drive and other areas at
Bone Rattle Music Limited, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audiopile Records, Bad Bird Media, Band Merch Canada, Vancouver Music Gallery, and Pandora's Box Rehearsal Studios.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station.
Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on.
College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
We are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, discussing the world of nonprofits, social justice, and activism. Well, before the break, I mentioned that we're going to be playing a clip from John Oliver's HBO show Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, talking about FIFA. So last week on the show, we discussed the corruption issues going on in Qatar, as well as the arrests of several top FIFA brass. And that story has only developed in the past couple of days. The president of FIFA resigned, although we don't know if that's going to keep him out of reach of the law or not. That sort of remains to be seen. But anyway, there was a great segment on John Oliver's show like a couple days ago or a day ago. And I wanted to play it for you. This is about 13 minutes. It's really funny, but it's also, I think, really interesting. So have a listen, and we'll return to the sector after this.
You may remember last year we examined what an appalling organization FIFA is, treating countries that host the World Cup like cash machines, practically imposing their own rule of law, generating billions of dollars, and yet somehow remaining a non-profit. Now, despite being almost the dictionary definition of corruption, they've escaped any significant prosecution for decades. But that all ended on Wednesday.
High-ranking officials from FIFA, the sport's governing body, arrested in an overnight raid in Switzerland, the result of a sweeping FBI investigation.
I don't know what I'm more surprised by, that FIFA officials were actually arrested or that America was behind it. It took the country that cares the least about football to bring down the people who have been ruining it. That's like finding out that Kesha arrested a group of bankers involved in commodities fraud. Wow, Kesha. I actually did not think this was an interest of yours. But you've been undeniably effective. Tenacious prosecution, Kay. It's not just the fact of the arrests that was spectacular. It's how they were carried out.
We saw several of those FIFA officials led from the hotel. I think it was the hotel staff trying to protect their appearance, if not their dignity, with white hotel sheets.
Oh, that is perfect, because hotel sheets are very much like FIFA officials. They really should be clean, but they're actually unspeakably filthy, and deep down, everybody knows that. Essentially, the US government has accused FIFA officials of soliciting $150 million in bribes and kickbacks in forms ranging from cash in a briefcase to an expensive painting, which, to be fair, is unexpectedly classy corruption for sports executives. Because if you wanted to bribe Roger Goodell, all you'd really need is a cardboard box filled with old Playboys. Apparently, the big breakthrough came when the IRS caught Chuck Blazer, a corrupt American FIFA official and actual bad Santa. For many years, Blazer didn't even file a tax return, which was a little suspicious considering the lifestyle he lived.
His criminal activity financed an opulent lifestyle that included a luxury apartment in New York's Trump Tower for the use of his cat.
Wow! None of us know what aloof really means until we meet a cat that has its own apartment in Trump Tower. He probably doesn't even lick himself, he just uses the on-site dry cleaning. Now, Blazer became an FBI informant, and with his help, the US government managed to produce a 164-page indictment, which I genuinely recommend that you read because it's amazing. Let me give you just a taste. For instance, it alleges that former FIFA Vice President Jack Warner tried to help buy votes with envelopes containing $40,000 in cash. And when someone objected, he said, "If you're pious, open a church, friends. Our business is our business." Which is not just awful, it's factually incorrect. Because opening a church is a fantastic way to make a shit ton of money. That's just a fact. And if you need any more proof that Jack Warner could not give less of a f***, listen to this. After he was arrested, he left jail in an ambulance claiming exhaustion. Exhaustion that he then recovered from miraculously quickly.
Hours after he was released from jail, the former FIFA exec turned politician was defiant as he addressed a rally.
That is cocky. Denying any involvement while singing "Every Little Thing's Gonna Be All Right." As songs go, that's a little on the nose. I guess we're just lucky that he didn't go with "Got Your Money" by Old Dirty Bastard. Which, come to think of it, are three words that describe Jack Warner perfectly. But the cherry on top of all of this was a video Jack Warner released just today where he suggested that this arrest was all a conspiracy, bringing hard proof in the form of a newspaper article stating that FIFA was trying to placate the US by giving them an extra World Cup this year.
FIFA has frantically announced 2015, this year, Olympic final in the World Cup begin May 27. If the FIFA is so bad, why is it the USA wants to keep the FIFA World Cup?
And let's be fair, he's right. FIFA giving the US an extra World Cup is comically ridiculous. It's the sort of thing you'd usually see in an Onion article, which it turns out was exactly what he was holding up there. And it says something. It says something about how corrupt FIFA is that one of their ex-vice presidents could look at that story and think, yeah, that sounds like something they might do. Yeah, yeah. But maybe the most remarkable thing about all of the charges is that they didn't touch Sepp Blatter, who's been president of FIFA for the last 17 years. Now, on his watch, the World Cup has left a trail of devastation. Just last year, Brazil spent billions of dollars on massive new stadiums to host the World Cup, stadiums which have met a predictable fate.
These days, there's very little football being played at the world's second most expensive stadium. In fact, it mostly sits empty. After hosting less than a handful of matches during last year's World Cup, it's never been filled again. Today, it serves mainly as a parking lot for these buses.
You have to give them credit. FIFA literally went into Brazil, paved paradise, and put up a parking lot. But that is just a drop in the ocean of what has happened on Blatter's watch. Just look at what's going to happen next Saturday when the Women's World Cup starts. Blatter has previously suggested raising the popularity of women's soccer by saying they could, for example, have tighter shorts. Female players are pretty. And it is rare to find a non-fired boss who will openly say, "I would like to make it easier for me to masturbate to my employees." And as you'll see next week, that is pretty much the full extent of Blatter's care for female players' legs.
Every game will be played, for the first time in history, on artificial turf. Many U.S. team members are livid.
It is a gender equality issue. No chance would the men ever play a World Cup on turf.
LaRue recently posted pictures of skin burns she says were caused by turf.
Holy shit. The last time an athlete's legs were beaten up that badly in advance of a major competition, it was because Tonya Harding was unwilling to settle for silver. No decision Blatter has overseen is more questionable than the 2022 World Cup being awarded to Qatar, because not only will the conditions be terrible to play in, but the number of migrant workers that have died in Qatar since the cup was announced has been staggering.
Now, the numbers are difficult to pin down, but a report by the International Trade Union Confederation, for example, has estimated 1,200 deaths so far, with up to 4,000 additional worker deaths by 2022.
Now, even if all those are not directly related to the World Cup, those are still natural disaster numbers. Weather services should start issuing FIFA warnings. A stadium is being planned in your area. Evacuate immediately. And you would think all this might cost Sepp Blatter his job. And on Friday, he was actually up for re-election as FIFA's president and offered a pretty terrible defense for himself.
I know many people hold me ultimately responsible for the actions and reputation of the global football community. We, or I, cannot monitor everyone all of the time.
That is weak. You are basically Charles Manson saying, listen, I've got a big family. I don't know what Squeaky gets up to half the time. And by this point, having learned what you know about FIFA, you have no right to be surprised by the result of Friday's election.
With all eyes on FIFA, the most powerful man in football, Sepp Blatter, has won a fifth term as president of that organization.
Come on! He presided over the worst fiasco in their history. It's like a Sony executive greenlighting a sequel in the middle of watching Aloha. This is absolutely terrible, and I need to make sure there's more of it. We'll call it Aloha 2. This time, we mean the other meaning. Blatter's re-election was absolutely a foregone conclusion. Everyone knew this was coming. And I can explain why. All 209 members in FIFA get a single vote for president. And a lot of those smaller members have a financial interest in keeping things exactly as they are.
All share equally the profits from the World Cup, regardless of size or soccer prowess.
Liechtenstein gets as much money as Germany. Andorra gets as much money as Spain, and Montserrat gets as much money as United States.
That's right. The US gets the same share as Montserrat, which A, isn't even a country, and B, has a population of less than 6,000. So America, a country with a population of 320 million, gets just as much as an island with a headcount matching that of a slightly overbooked Caribbean cruise. And that's why, under FIFA's system, leadership never changes. Their elections are such a joke that 4 years ago, Blatter ran unopposed. This was the actual ballot paper from that year. And they should at least have added a second box so that your options were vote Blatter or go f*** yourself. And the problem is, all the arrests in the world are going to change nothing as long as Blatter is still there. Because to truly kill a snake, you must cut off its head, or in this case, its arsehole. But if America keeps driving this investigation, this is important. If America keeps driving this investigation and actually finds something to indict him, I don't think you understand how much that would mean to everyone on Earth. The whole world's opinion of America would change overnight. Let me put this in terms you might understand. If the Dutch somehow found a reason to extradite and lock up Donald Trump, you would think, holy shit, the Dutch are awesome. The Dutch are amazing. What a country. That is what is on the table for you, America. And if you won't do it, the last hope to get rid of him is in the hands of the only group even more powerful than world governments.
Right now, he's being backed because the money's still flowing in. The second Nike says goodbye, or the second Visa says goodbye, or Adidas, or Coca-Cola, or Budweiser, I guarantee you FIFA will not, the heads of FIFA will not have the support they currently enjoy.
Exactly. Barring an indictment, the only people with the power to get rid of Sepp Blatter are FIFA's sponsors, these companies, and I would like to make a plea to them tonight. Please, make Sepp Blatter go away. I will do anything. Adidas, I'll wear one of your ugly shoes. One of these shoes that make me look like the Greek god of aspiring DJs. McDonald's, I will take a bite out of every item on your dollar menu, which tastes like normal food that was cursed by a vindictive wizard. And I will even make the ultimate sacrifice. Budweiser, if you pull your support and help get rid of Blatter, I will put my mouth where my mouth is and I will personally drink one of your disgusting items. I'm serious. It can be a Bud Light. I will even drink a Bud Light Lime. Despite the fact that all the lime in the world cannot disguise the fact that this tastes like a puddle beneath a Long John Silver's dumpster. But I will do it. I will drink one, maintaining eye contact with the camera, and I will say it was delicious. Because if you get rid of the Swiss demon who has ruined the sport I love, this stuff will taste like f***ing champagne.
And we are back here on The Sector. That was John Oliver on his segment over FIFA. Very entertaining stuff. So, obviously, since that has aired, Sepp Blatter has resigned as FIFA president. That occurred only a couple of days ago. Blatter announced that a special election would occur on December 2015 and in March 2016 to appoint his successor. Now, the question remains, is he being forced out by the investigation? Was he forced out by his cohorts in the organization? Exactly what happened? That's going to be difficult to parse out right now, at least. However, according to ABC, Blatter is being investigated by the FBI and U.S. prosecutors. So it remains to be seen. His resignation has not allowed him to escape punishment for, you know, what he's done. So perhaps John Oliver will, you know, get some closure for this. And, you know, we'll keep following this. It is very interesting to watch how the world of sports is able to handle kind of internal corruption and internal, well, just evilness, really. Anyway, we will take a break here on The Sector and return after this.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
Shut up! Shut up and listen to me right now. This is Fred Schneider, and you're listening to CITR. Shut up and listen to this radio station.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow. Now, just a reminder, if you would like to participate in The Sector, you can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. If you'd like to tweet us, I'm at Ethan Clow, and The Sector is at Sector Podcast, of course, on Twitter. And we're also on Facebook, facebook.com/sectorpodcast. And of course, our podcast, our show notes, all the information about our show is available at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. Well, last week on the show, I talked a bit about being a nonprofit employee. What does that entail? What do you sign up for when you become an employee of a nonprofit? The stress, the sort of jack-of-all-trades kind of job situation that you have where you're doing a bit of everything, and of course the, you know, ramifications of working in the nonprofit sector, working for a charity as opposed to working for a big corporation. What can you expect in terms of remuneration? What's the work culture, the organizational culture of the place that you're in? Well, recently, a few days ago, I saw an article on Charity Village talking about how to attract and keep millennials in the nonprofit sector. So, that's, you know, this kind of fits in very nicely with that conversation that we had last week. So I thought, let's take a look at that and compare and contrast and see what they have to say. So first of all, a millennial. Now, roughly speaking, that is anywhere between someone born between 1980 and 2000. That demographic makes up the bulk of the workforce, definitely either entering it or recently entering it into the workforce in the last decade or so. So most of us are in that demographic. I'm in it. I think a lot of our listeners are probably in it. So the question, of course, is, you know, what are millennials looking for? What do they want? And what can they offer the nonprofit world? And perhaps more importantly, what can the nonprofit world offer millennials? Now, the generational, I guess, descriptions, the viewpoints of what each generation wants, you know, Generation X, the baby boomers, millennials, Gen Y, or, you know, however we want to refer to it, sometimes these ideas are not exactly well-founded in any kind of research. It's more based on kind of what a perception of this generation wants. Millennials have been described as special, in quotation marks, sheltered, confident, team-oriented, conventional, pressured, and achieving. Some of those terms seem self-contradictory, so we will try to examine them a bit more clearly. One area that millennials are generally typecasted as being unwilling to work as former generations did before them. Millennials want to work hard, play hard. They want to have a company that appreciates a work-life balance. They want to have a company that offers a flexible work schedule, accommodations for life, and, you know, the fact that life sometimes throws you curveballs. They don't want to have the kind of job where you punch in, punch out, and, you know, whatever comes up, and people who work hard manage to work through their personal life, and, you know, you don't complain, you don't raise your voice, et cetera, kind of a very sort of button down, head down, kind of straight line progression. Millennials want something different. They want a work space environment that reflects their personal life, it reflects their personal values. Now, one would suggest that this would actually mean that millennials are perfectly suited for a nonprofit career. As we talked about on last week's show, the nonprofit sector seems to kind of revolve around similar ideas. And yet, the information that we have is not really clear on whether or not millennials do prefer the nonprofit sector. A 2013 Millennial Impact Research report indicated that 72% of millennials were eager to join a nonprofit organization, but a 2009 Ipsos Reid survey found that only 2% of this group identified the nonprofit sector as their preferred field. A 2015 survey of high school students by the Youth and Philanthropy Initiative found that 65% of them would not consider a job or career in the charitable sector. Both the YPI survey and a recent survey by the Peel Children and Youth Initiative found that millennial perception of the charitable sector is very positive, even if they don't see it as a viable career option. So, okay, it's very unclear if the nonprofit sector is appealing to the millennials. Whether or not they'd be the right fit, I guess, remains to be seen. Now, this could be a result of education, meaning that millennials, especially those coming out of university at this sort of date and time, aren't really sure that the nonprofit sector can be a viable career opportunity. And this has led, I think, a lot of people to brainstorm ways to get that in front of today's youth. The question being, but how? You know, we can use things like social media, LinkedIn, whatever. But one interesting suggestion is that charities need to do a better job of making their presence felt to university students, going to job fairs, for instance. And this is something that I can recall. I mean, when I was at UBC, and whenever a job fair rolled around, there'd be banks, there would be law firms, consultancies, travel agencies, all kinds of different companies and industries represented. But very, very few did you ever see a nonprofit or a charity there. And that was, you know, obviously a mistake, because if you don't see the fact that a charity is out there doing good work, the only time that you ever do see them on campus is when they're asking for money. It gives you kind of a negative perception of them, and it doesn't make you think that they'd be a viable career opportunity. But, I mean, the benefit, of course, for a charity or a nonprofit is that more often than not, millennials want to work at a company that has a work policy that they feel fits their particular political viewpoint. That's where those, you know, About Us pages on your website become so important. If a charity is able to tell their story, if they are able to talk about what it is that they want to do, their mission statement, their goals for a society, and how they go about doing that, that's something that will people will naturally gravitate towards, especially if you have a social conscience. If you're one of those people who says, you know, do I just want to work for anybody for a paycheck? If the answer is no, and you want to have a type of job that you feel proud of, that you feel like reflects your life and reflects your values, then of course you're going to look at the nonprofit sector and say, wow, you know, look at all these people who are trying to do good in life. And, you know, the great thing with the nonprofit sector is that when you are trying to do good things in the world and people are listening to you, that's one of the, I think, most rewarding aspects is that for a lot of nonprofits, if they're into policy or if they're into any kind of advocacy, you know, a lot of times they do get listened to. I mean, you know, obviously certain groups more so than others, you know, the environment tends to be on the downside of that whole equation. But there are, in fact, a lot of organizations that do have access to politicians, that do have access to policy planners. And I think for a lot of people, that's a very rewarding feeling to know that the work you're putting into it is actually getting utilized. In the nonprofit world, you know, that's something that I've noticed really well is that depending on really, you know, whatever sort of scale you enter it in, you're part of a team and your opinion will get listened to. And that's something that I think, you know, a lot of millennials really care about. Nobody wants to go into a situation where they're just a cog. You know, they're just a brick in the machine that turns things out, and you never really feel like you have any creativity or feel that you have any real input. Whereas the nonprofit sector is structured completely differently. You want to get that input. You want to get that feedback. And indeed, with the opportunities in the nonprofit sector, advancing to a point where you have sizable authority and also a decent amount of responsibility tends to take a lot less longer than working in the corporate world. So that's, again, another reason why a millennial would want to focus their energy on the nonprofit world. Often, though, the conversation does eventually turn back into money. And again, nonprofits, whether or not it is a reality, they generally have a perception, at least, and sometimes a reality, that they cannot match the sort of salaries that you could make in the for-profit sector. That being said, if you also look at the amount of freedom or the amount of work-life balance that you find in the for-profit sector, it's definitely lacking compared to the nonprofit sector. And this, again, is something that if the nonprofit sector makes a good job of pointing out, if they do a good job of making people aware of this, that can help motivate them to enter the field. Now, money, of course, is an interesting thing because people often assume that if you're concerned about money, especially in the nonprofit sector, then you're just greedy. Then you're one of the people who, you know, wants to make a six-figure income in a charity, and that makes you a bad person. And we've kind of talked about this perception in the past. One of the interesting things, of course, is that for millennials, for people who are, you know, in my demographic, money is actually kind of a really important thing because we are seeing a major change in how the economy works and what sort of benefits you can expect to receive over the course of your life. This is obviously a part of a bigger conversation, but just in short, I mean, between 2000 and 2010, the National Consumer Price Index rose 22%, but in the same period, tuition fees increased an average of 51%. So millennials are paying more for basic necessities, and they're paying more than tuition, than their parents and grandparents did before them. The average Canadian university graduate has $27,000 in student debt. Youth unemployment in 2014 was 13.9%, which is shockingly large. And virtually half of 15 to 24-year-olds are working in jobs such as sales, service, and retail, while one in four millennials with a university degree is working in a low-skill job. A university degree is not getting you what it once did. It is no longer a guarantee that if you have a BA, you'll be making decent money. You'll be making enough money to pay off your tuition. And indeed, you know, not that we're saying that it's all about money, but you can't live in our society without money. So if you expect to do good for yourself in society, there is a strong motivational force pushing you into the quickest and fastest way to make money, and that mostly is the for-profit sector, and that mostly involves sacrificing a lot of work-life balance, which is something that millennials hate to do. And honestly, who would want to do that? Because that's a really awful way to live. This has given rise to that perception that millennials are sort of greedy and they want everything and they want it now. Well, there's a lot of pressure at this day and age for students who are coming out of university with this kind of future in store for them, with debt, with a very high unemployment rate, and chances are a job economy that is not going to reward them for their degree. It's a pretty dismal future, actually, now that I think about it, and it's kind of depressing me a little bit. But the point being, of course, is that if the nonprofit sector wants to appeal to millennials, then they need to do a very good job of explaining how the nonprofit sector differs from the for-profit area in terms of money, in terms of benefits, in terms of work-life balance. Another factor that's pointed out by the article is the role of parents in this whole thing. For a lot of students who are coming out of university, whether they're in their early to late 20s, they're dealing with student debt. They're dealing with the cost of education, which in a lot of cases they didn't bear themselves. Their parents may have helped them out. They may have paid half. They may have paid all of it. Who knows? And their parents want to see their kids move out, get jobs, start paying their own way and getting on with their life. Now, again, that doesn't change the fact that the realities of the job market have changed, as we've just discussed. So there's a lot of pressure on the millennial generation to start earning. And if you go into the nonprofit sector and you say, okay, here's a great job that lets me live the life that I want to live. It's got decent benefits. They're paying me a livable wage, which, let's face it, is, depending on where you are in Canada, it can be very different. But, you're not making a lot of money. And for parents who see their kids with their university degrees and they've spent all this time and energy doing that, and then they see them making, maybe $30,000 to $35,000 a year, that's a bit disheartening. And so the pressure is on to get a job that pays you $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year. Of course, a university degree does not buy you one of those jobs anymore. So, what are you to do? How can the nonprofit sector make itself an option for these people who feel this pressure? What can they do? I mean, honestly, what can they do? That remains to be seen. I don't really have an answer for that, nor does the article really present any, I think, groundbreaking suggestions. They do actually have a top 10 list, a countdown of what attracts millennials to the nonprofit sector. So maybe just take a look at this and we'll see how that stacks up with what we've talked about here on the show. Number 10, strive for diversity in leadership. Again, that that makes a lot of sense. If you're looking for a career that offers you a break from the for-profit sector, having leadership that, breaks away from sort of the old white male sort of control structure to something that's a bit more diverse, a bit more different, then that's going to appeal to a lot of people. Number 9, offer flexibility in working arrangements. Again, big factor there. A lot of millennials, they don't want the standard 9-to-5 job. They want something that's more flexible, that allows them to incorporate their life, their social life, their family life. This goes all the way from things like maternity leave to paternity leave, as well as the ability to offer a flexible condition so that sometimes you can work from home. If you have to, drive your kid to school or band practice or whatever it is they do, that you have a job that's flexible with that and you're not going to get the guilt trip every time you have to ask for, an extra hour here or there. Number 8, use social media to tell your story. Well, again, go where people are. If people are on Facebook, if they're on LinkedIn, if they're on Twitter, go there and start talking about yourself. Explain why you're a good organization. That's obviously going to have a lot of results. Number 7, offer benefits and more security. Again, if you can't offer the same kind of competitive wage, offset that with health benefits, any other kind of benefit that you can think of that would make someone feel like they have more job security. Number 6, explain more clearly the career opportunities that are available in the sector. Again, that makes perfect sense. Number 5, don't be scared by youth. Be open to adopt new ideas and points of view. This is something that we've actually talked about this on the show previously. We did an episode on kind of the generational conflicts that can emerge in the workplace. Having a work culture where age is not a barrier for working together can be incredibly tricky, but it can be done. And it's, I think it's something that's really important. If you have an environment where the older workers, the older employees feel like they have a right to talk down to younger employees, that's going to create a lot of tension. So again, keeping that in mind and creating a more adaptable job environment. Number four, offer real and meaningful experience. Internships and co-ops either pay or lead to jobs. You know, again, that's definitely something that you want to look into. The other important thing, I think, is also treating employees with the same level of respect that you would come from understanding that it is a small sector. You know, I've had conversations with some of my friends in the nonprofit sector, and we sometimes forget that almost everybody knows everybody else. It's not a huge industry yet. So if you're going to hire somebody or put out a call for employees, make sure that you get back to people. You don't want to create a perception that your organization is, you know, selfish or standoffish or whatever. You want to make sure that people know that you're a good place to work. And that goes into, you know, protecting your reputation. Number three, provide professional development opportunities. Again, hugely important for millennials. People want to improve their skills. Number two, offer actual entry-level positions with room to grow in advance. This is a big one. This is something that I've personally ranted about, again, amongst some of my friends. The nonprofit sector, we have a tendency to not advertise the entry-level positions. And furthermore, we don't do a very good job of even explaining how to get one. And this is a problem that I've encountered, like literally, when I was starting out, I would email organizations and ask for advice. And the responses that I got ranged from sort of downright rude to like nonsensical. Suggestions that I'm talking to the wrong people, or, you know, email this person, and then that person would say, well, email this person. So the nonprofit sector has to do a better job of explaining how one even starts their career in the nonprofit world. How do you even go about getting a job here? Where does it lead you? What skills will you get? What do you need to move on to the next stage? We have a tendency to only sort of advertise and only recruit the top positions, the top tiers, the directors and the executives and whatnot. And that's really unfortunate because, you know, that it's kind of geared towards somebody who's already spent like 10 years in the industry, but there's really no support for someone who's spent a year or two in the industry. So we need to improve that aspect of things. And then finally, pay a living wage. You know, obviously very important for the millennials. You know, and the tricky part about paying a living wage is, well, paying it, really. I mean, finding the resources to do that can be tricky. And this is, again, I think an area where there can be reasonable disagreement on how to go about doing this. There is one school of thought that nonprofits have to grow to support their, you know, staff growth. I've always felt that if you can't afford to pay somebody a living wage, I mean, and I guess living wage is going to be, again, dependent on where you live and what the standard of living is in that area. But if you can't afford to bring someone on at a living wage, at a wage that is at least sustainable, you shouldn't be hiring. And I know that sounds harsh, but I really think that if you're looking around and saying, okay, we need X, Y, and Z done here at our base of operations, our department, our nonprofit. We need to bring someone who can do these sort of things. What can we afford to pay them? Well, not a lot. Minimum wage. And let's face it, minimum wage is not really a living wage. It's way below average. If you can't put together the resources necessary, then you have to really think, okay, maybe we need help, but can we sustain help? And that's something that you have to, I think, give really serious thought to. And that's, you know, a board conversation, of course, but I think it's an ethical one. Bringing somebody on when you can't really give them the fair wage they've earned for doing a good job, it's a little bit wrong, morally and ethically. You shouldn't do that to somebody. Now, people may disagree, and that's totally fine. I'd love to hear from you. So you can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. And of course, we're on Twitter at Ethan Clow at sectorpodcast. We'll take a quick break here on the show. We'll return after this.
This is the sound of compost and recyclables going into the garbage. Garbage that ends up in the landfill creating greenhouse gases. This is the sound of a more sustainable campus. You can make a difference when you sort it out. Learn more at sustain.ubc.ca/sortitout.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
We are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Well, we're actually getting close to wrapping up for today's show on episode 46. But before we do that, I wanted to talk a bit about the Truth and Reconciliation recommendations, which are, of course, is part of the commission that was investigating Canada's residential school history over a six-year period. For those of you who don't know, the Residential Schools Program was started by Canada in conjunction with many of the Christian churches of the time and was instituted not long after 1876 and operated until about 1996. During that time, First Nations children were removed from their families and placed in these residential boarding schools in an effort to assimilate them into Canadian culture. The schools, to say the least, were disastrous in their implementation of this. Disastrous in the sense of what they did. This was fully intended by the process. These schools were horrific for these children, resulted in many of them dying, families being destroyed, and cultural the cultural devastation to the First Nations is probably never to be recovered. In fact, the report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has labeled this cultural genocide, which is a shocking and damning conviction on the whole affair. The commission has released 94 recommendations that are designed to help heal this divide. The recommendations were released along with an almost 400-page summary of the final report. A much larger version won't be released until later this year. Now, the government, which has been almost completely silent on the issue, has said that they will not act until the final report, which could push any kind of reaction beyond the election happening later this year. Now, obviously, there is a lot of political pressure for the Canadian government to do anything, something about this. There's also a lot of, I think, pressure in Canadian society to finally acknowledge this for what it is. And again, the term cultural genocide should not be taken lightly. What's interesting is some of the reaction has been, in some cases, I think, heartening in the sense that people are talking about this and they're saying how inappropriate it is for the government of Canada to have no reaction to this. And I think that was kind of exemplified in an article that was trending a little while ago where at the ceremony, Tom McClair, the NDP leader, was standing, whereas the Minister of Aboriginal Affairs, Bernard Valcourt, refused to stand from his seat in the first row. And you can see pictures of everyone around him standing and applauding the report, except for him, who's sitting there with this smug look on his face. And there's this great shot of Tom McClair looking over, just the same kind of shame and disgust on his face that I'm sure many Canadians would feel about this. So the response from government has been almost totally lacking. And what response this is going to invoke from First Nations groups remains to be seen. But the whole point of a Truth and Reconciliation commission like this is to obviously find truth and reconcile those differences. And if the government is not going to even make an attempt to do that, well, that's just plain evil. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. And further, I mean, the point being is that Justice Murray Sinclair, who steered the commission, as well as First Nation leaders, are not calling for a delayed response. They're calling for immediate action. And it's just really too bad that the government of Canada is dragging its heels on this. One of the major points, of course, raised was the a dramatic change in focus for how the government of Canada deals with First Nations groups, as opposed to kind of a one-size-fits-all, approaching a nation-by-nation approach, so that the government would work individually with First Nations groups and find solutions that work for those situations, and not trying to shoehorn everybody into one solution that is not even, I mean, when you try to do that with so many different people with all these diverse problems, it's not going to solve anything. Of course, one of the major factors, of course, is education and educational support for all these students, many of whom are descended from, you know, survivors of the residential school program. And we've talked about in the past here in the sector that Tom McClair has promised a NDP investigation or a public inquiry into the murdered and missing Aboriginal women. And that was, you know, a topic that we discussed before. And the Conservative government's response to that was, well, this was a law enforcement issue. And again, it's that one-size-fits-all, heavy-handed, or ham-fisted, I guess we could say, approach to solving these problems. And I think, if anything, here on the sector, what we've been talking about on today's episode, as well as been talking about for however long we've been doing this show, is that certain problems require a nuanced, specific, and ultimately well-thought-out, crafted solution. We can't just hammer out a kind of generalized stamp of fixing and just go around and, you know, plunk things and go, okay, this problem is fixed. It doesn't work that way. Now, like I said, I'm not going to get too much more into the Truth and Reconciliation. I'm going to hopefully say that for next week's episode of The Sector. We'll try to dive into that in a bit more detail and obviously talk a bit more about the history and the fallout. We'll see where that goes. Anyway, we're running out of time here on the show, so I want to thank you all for tuning in and listening. It's been a great pleasure to do the show once again. This has been episode 46 of The Sector. As always, we'll be back next week on CITR from a new studio, a brand new station here on the UBC campus. Alrighty then, well, this is Ethan Clow, your host of The Sector, saying thank you for listening. We will see you all next week, same time, same channel. Have a great weekend and have a great day. Goodbye. I feel your love. I feel your strong love. I feel the patience of unconditional love. Strength. I feel your faith in me. I'll never let you down, no matter what you do. If you just walk with me and let me walk with you.